From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Rising fuel prices aren't just bad for drivers. They're forcing the transportation industry to scale back, too. Just yesterday, United Airlines said it would cut roughly 950 pilots. There is one exception, though, to the fuel frustration: railroads. Their stock prices are up, and they're hauling more freight. And rather than relax back in the caboose, they've mounted an aggressive marketing campaign, one they hope will take more freight away from the struggling American trucking industry. NPR's John McChesney reports.
Their media campaign is everywhere, on television, NPR, and other radio networks.
Railroads now take the equivalent of 9 million trucks a year off the highway and put them on trains. That's enough to make an environmentalist smile.
That's from the American Association of Railroads website, and it's clear the Iron Horse wants to run more trucks off the road. One clever ad by the Norfolk and Southern Railroad is called The Lonely Gallon.
Heard you coming back to town, hoping that you'll come around and see me. Thinking about
what if there was a way to move goods efficiently using less fuel? Norfolk Southern, the future of transportation.
A forlorn group of gas cans watches a train go by without stopping. Their spouts droop. Then they march over a hill and find their new love, trucks. Their spouts rise in salute. But it's not as if railroads don't burn a lot of diesel. We went to Roseville, California, where the nation's largest railroad, Union Pacific, puts trains together for national destinations. There, the railroad is teaching locomotive engineers how to save fuel. A 100-car train pulls out of the switching yard, headed over the Sierra Mountains through historic Donner Pass, back to the Midwest. Inside a brand new locomotive cab, engineer Gary Cousin sits in relative quiet as he begins the long climb. As he eases the train forward, he watches two LCD screens full of information. His hand rests next to three long handles, a throttle, a dynamic brake, and an air brake. Turns out that dynamic brake is really important in saving fuel.
Dynamic braking is to slow the train down without using the brake shoes on throughout the entire train. We can slow this train down by using dynamic braking.
Seems complicated, but if Cousin uses the air brakes on all the cars to slow down, the engine is essentially dragging those braking cars. Dynamic braking uses the engine's power to decelerate. Union Pacific is also investing in new engines to use less fuel and create less pollution. But even without new technology, Union Pacific spokesperson Zoe Richmond says rail enjoys economic and environmental advantages.
1 ton of freight can move 431 miles on 1 gallon of diesel on a train.
We asked Tim Lynch of the American Trucking Association if his industry has a comparable figure.
We don't. We're often asked, you know, how do you refute that? And my answer, our answer is, I don't know that that's a correct number or not.
Well, according to Chris Hendrickson, an expert on these matters who teaches at Carnegie Mellon University, Union Pacific isn't blowing smoke with that figure.
According to the national statistics, you can go about 420 ton miles per gallon. So they're doing a little bit better than the average.
That, says Hendrickson, is about 10 times more efficient than trucks. But the comparison irritates the Truckers Association's Tim Lynch, who says railroads just can't get along without trucks.
It is at times a little aggravating, slamming their number one customer. I don't know too many other industries that would do that.
The advantage railroads enjoy really only applies to long-haul truckers. Railroads can't deliver point to point. They need trucks to get containers and automobiles and so on from the railhead to the final stop. At a truck stop near Sacramento, one of the last fuel stops before crossing the Sierras, two long-haul drivers were on their cell phones trying to get credit extensions to buy diesel, which was selling at $5 a gallon. Glenn Yates buys only 50 gallons.
How much does it cost you?
$2.52.
Glenn Yates buys only 50 gallons for $252. Yates says he'll top off in Nevada where it's a little less expensive.
So the trains say they can do it cheaper. What do you think?
Yeah, they can do it cheaper. They can't get it there on time.
That's mainly because of congestion on rail lines. But in this epic battle, timeliness may be one of the few remaining advantages that long-haul truckers enjoy over railroads if fuel prices stay this high. John McChesney, NPR News.
food prices have hit some schools hard, which means more cost-cutting measures when schools get back in the fall. Tina Antolini of member station WFCR visited one cafeteria in New England just before the school year ended last Friday.
You want a fajita, hon? Those are pork burgers.
It's evident from the mood of the cafeteria at Fairview Middle School in Chicopee, Massachusetts, that summer vacation is only a few days off. Kids barely stay long enough to shovel in the day's menu of pork burgers and chicken fajitas with pineapple for dessert. But District Food Services Director Joanne Lennon is already worried she won't be able to serve some of these items next year.
I'm concerned about my hamburger rolls next year. I mean, we're serving those today. Pineapple, it's hard to find, and the price of that is astronomical. So I might have to probably maybe not even buy pineapple next year.
And pineapple is just the start. All sorts of cafeteria staples, from bread to paper products, are rising in price. Lennon says right now she's been told to expect about an 8% jump in the cost of food for next year.
We don't know. There's so many unexpected things that just keep on popping up, saying, oh my God, corn's going to go $8 a bushel. So right now it's 8%, but maybe in October it could be 15%.
Lennon had a taste of sticker shock this year when milk prices rose 21%, an added expense of almost $60,000 to her overall budget of $3 million a year. She handled that by raising the price of the a la carte items the school cafeterias offer, like individual cookies and juice drinks. But such patches only go so far. And while cafeterias do get a certain amount of what they spend on each lunch reimbursed by the federal government, Lennon says that reimbursement just isn't keeping pace with this year's inflation.
We get maybe a 3-cent increase a year per meal from the federal government, and no way is that going to cover this cost.
It's gotten bad enough that many districts are raising lunch prices for next year. Lennon says she's holding off because any rise in price could mean a drop-off in the number of student customers she has, which could further gouge her bottom line. And more than half of the students in her district come from low-income families.
And if I could help the parents out by not going up on something else, they're already paying high prices for gas. For their home food, they're paying a lot more. So I said, well, if I can keep at least lunch prices the same, maybe they'll still be able to afford to give them a nutritious lunch every day.
So Chicopee is finding other ways to fill the gaps. Extras like Jell-O and cake are out. And Fairview cook manager Susan Lacasse says one day's leftover spaghetti goes into the next day's soup.
And now we're cooking more from scratch. That's going to save a lot. With our soups and our sauces are all from scratch rather than frozen or pre-made.
But not all school districts are equipped to do anything more than just reheat. Joanne Lennon says because of her district's kitchen ingenuity, the food price increases haven't yet interfered with her ability to provide nutritious meals for kids. But it is a precarious balance. Just try making a healthful paper bag lunch for $1.60 a pop. For NPR News, I'm Tina Antolini.
The children of migrant farm workers in the U.S. face special challenges when it comes to education. As their parents follow the harvest from state to state, many kids are forced to travel from school to school. Immokalee, Florida, is the largest center for migrant workers in the eastern United States. Educators there are trying some new tactics to make sure these children stay in school long enough to graduate. NPR's Larry Abramson has the first of two stories.
Immokalee means my home in the Seminole language, but this city in south central Florida looks more like a way station than a true home. There are rows and rows of dilapidated trailers for the families who live here part of the year, then move on in the spring to follow the agricultural harvest. So what's it like trying to get an education here? Juan Medina knows.
I'm a former migrant myself, so it took me about four different high schools. By the time I would, you know, during my lifespan, you know, migrating from Texas to Georgia to Florida and being in different high schools. So I can sympathize and I understand the migrant life because I'm one of them, okay?
For years, Medina worked the fields with his family, planting onions in West Texas, picking tomatoes in Homestead, Florida. But today, Medina works for the Florida Department of Education, trying to help kids deal with the challenges of migrant life. As we drive around town in Medina's white van, this doesn't really look like a town of 20,000 people. There are few places to eat or hang out. But for Medina, this is a real home, something he barely had growing up.
I didn't have a dad growing up, okay? Had a father, left us. Had a stepfather, he also left us. So kind of a rough life.
Juan Medina's hair and mustache are still jet black, making him an awfully young-looking grandfather. He is a family man, and his family includes just about everyone in Immokalee.
Hola, señor Silva. Buenos días. ¿Cómo está? ¿Qué dice el tomate?
Medina pulls into Pinhooker's Market to show me how some of his kids have done. Medina oversees a summer program at the local high school for kids trying to catch up. Programs like these have helped some students stay in school. One young man in a white Immokalee High t-shirt comes up to the car.
David.
David, what's your last name?
Ayala.
Yeah. So you graduated?
Yeah, I graduated back in 2004.
Yeah.
He used to Mr. Medina make sure you graduated?
Yeah. Back in my sophomore year, I wanted to drop out, but he was talking to me, encouraged me not to drop out, so I went and go ahead and graduate after all.
In fact, David Ayala was on his way to the airport, headed to classes at the University of Dallas. The produce market is piled high with humongous watermelons and other produce. They're beautiful, but they are also part of the temptation that pulls many kids out of school.
So how's business?
This is one of my young high school kids, okay? Started his own business.
We pull up next to a teenager with a big grin on his face. Francisco Parra never finished high school.
Why did you quit?
Work, farming.
Yeah,
I wanted to work.
And help out his parents?
Yeah, I wanted to come up.
Juan Medina doesn't win over every kid here.
Buenos dias, ¿cómo está?
At our next stop, Medina introduces me to Florencia Ramos and her kids, third grader Fabian and his big brother, Efrain. Dad isn't home. He's up the road, as they say, picking watermelon in Georgia. And this year, the family couldn't come along.
Porque tiene un año y no puede pararse sola ni caminar.
She has a year old and she still can't stand up.
The daughter needs physical therapy. But the fact that the family has to stay home could be good for Efrain, a rising fifth grader with a big round face and a little tuft of hair in the front that he's carefully gelled into place into a cool little wave. Efrain's outgoing and smart, but his grades are all over the place.
A, B, C's, and F's.
And why?
What did you get an F in?
Language arts and social studies.
Efrain is sitting in the shade. Resting on his knees is a tool that Juan Medina hopes will keep him in school. It's a little laptop known as an XO. This durable little machine was designed by the One Laptop Per Child program, primarily with third world communities in mind. But thanks to a small pilot program in Immokalee, Efrain and 45 other kids have gotten their own laptops. It belongs to them, not to the school, not to mom and dad. Efrain has already created a little interactive story on it.
These are like sponges.
I'm sorry, and what is this?
A pineapple.
Oh, that's a pineapple. And so the sponges are trying to get inside the door of the pineapple?
So then they're trying to measure it like a permit, and they could fit in it.
Uh-huh.
Okay, it's a little hard to explain. But basically, Efrain is already writing his own stories, and he's learning something about computer programming. But is that what low-income kids in this community really need? Teachers try to answer that question in tomorrow's story. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. There's an ongoing debate over what role speculators are playing in the run-up of oil prices. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing this morning. Yesterday, a House panel heard testimony that speculators are a major factor in surging prices. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The day-long hearing of the House Energy Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations heard from regulators, market chiefs, and analysts, everyone but the speculators themselves. The consensus was that traders of what's termed paper barrels of oil, as opposed to the real thing, have a lot to answer for. Michael Masters of Masters Capital Management said it wasn't quite accurate to call the current energy price run-up a bubble.
What we're talking about here with speculation, the right terminology really isn't a bubble. It's really more like a tumor, and it grows and grows and grows. And in this case, it's hurtful as it expands. So the time to act is before it gets any worse.
Congressional Democrats appear poised to act. Subcommittee Chairman Michigan Democrat Bart Stupak has sponsored what he's dubbed the Prevent Unfair Manipulation of Prices, or Pump Act. It would require greater disclosure of energy trades and stricter regulations aimed at curbing excessive speculation. Fadel Gate, an oil analyst with Oppenheimer & Company, says such speculation is a major factor that has led to oil costing twice as much as it should.
So it should be around between $45 and $60. So, you know, meeting with the head of most of the oil companies that we cover only a year ago, they were amazed at the sustainability of $60 oil.
Gates says the world hasn't changed that much since then to justify the much higher prices. But there are skeptics, such as Texas Republican Joe Barton. He told the subcommittee they're pointing fingers in the wrong direction.
Let me say at the very beginning that speculators are not the cause of high energy prices. We have high energy prices because there's less than a 1 or 2% margin of supply over demand in world markets today.
The Bush administration has also raised doubt, saying it's inadequate supplies and growing demand by India and China that have led to the price run-up. But recently, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission has begun an investigation into oil speculation, and a separate task force promises to report to Congress in the fall on the issue. Michigan Democrat John Dingell indicated he didn't need to wait for a task force to report on the obvious.
So we got here a situation where you got an elephant, which is a speculation, and you got the oil, which is moving, which is a flea on the back of that elephant. The flea wants to go somewhere, but he can only go on the elephant. And the elephant can go anywhere he wants, but the flea's got to go along.
Dingell says it's time for Congress to intervene with the elephant and the flea. Among the many possibilities lawmakers are considering are new requirements that speculators put in more money when they make a trade, and even barring speculators from trading oil altogether. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.